Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
To episode 97 of See Here podcast. I'm joined as usual by my wonderful compadre and co-host, Mr. Bernard Stickwell.
Hello.
We are not joined this month by our other wonderful compadre and co-host, Mr. Tim Merrill, because he's gone to a Brian Wilson fan club convention this month. So we'll have to hold down the fort for that.
That's some ironic timing, isn't it? I guess that yes. He should go and go to that just as we're talking to who we're going to talk to.
Yes, we are going to be talking to another B. Wilson, but his name is Brent Wilson, not related to Brian Wilson. Now, long-time listeners of See Here may remember that name because about a year and a half ago, I spoke to Brent while Bernie and Tim were unavailable. I was joined by my friend and local doo-wop expert, Peter Merritt. We spoke with Brent about his excellent documentary, Streetlight Harmonies. I think you can watch that now on Canopy, but search out for that one, Great History on Doo-Wop. I really recommend that. But his latest film is a documentary on Brian Wilson. And I know what you're thinking. You think, but aren't there a lot of other films about Brian Wilson? Yes, there are. But Brent has taken a different road. He's taken a long promise different. I can't make that work. Never mind. His new documentary is called Brian Wilson. Never mind. His new film is called Brian Wilson, A Long Promised Road. And we'll talk when we get into the interview about the approach that he takes. But Bernie and I are both fans of this film. We highly recommend it, even if you're not necessarily a longtime Beach Boys fan. And why wouldn't you be? So what we're going to do now is we're going to play the trailer, and we're going to be back in a moment with our discussion with Brent. And then we'll be back at the end of the interview to talk about what we have planned for next month on See Here.
Brian just threw away the rule book, just took you out of where you were and took you to another place.
There was no greater world created in rock and roll than the Beach Boys. The level of musicianship, I don't think anybody's touched it yet.
To dream up these textures that never existed before. That's why people say Brian's a genius.
You know, the rooftop is down. The story begins.
I'm digging up.
The beauty of it carries with it a sense of joyfulness, even in the pain of living.
You know there's something going on with Brian Wilson. There's no hiding that this man is troubled, trying to escape something.
And the pressure that comes with that, you know, the pressure to continue to be the person that people think you are supposed to be.
The idea of doing an interview makes Brian nervous.
And this is kind of where things got difficult for you, huh?
Yeah.
What was going on?
I don't know. I was having mental problems.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll often ask if we can just take a drive and listen to some music.
Well, I get anxious like it's getting a lot.
So this was all where the house was, right here?
Yeah.
We can get out?
You know, I just want to look at
it. It should get better, really.
There it is. Look. There it is.
This marks the spot.
They said go out and get a steady job.
The fact that he's still here and making music, that's a miracle, kind of, isn't it?
I don't know how you do that.
One, two, three.
To get me through again.
I got this terrible feeling in my chest, you know? I'm nervous.
You got this. That must have been a really exciting time.
It was. It was a trip.
So hard to answer futures riddle when a head seems so wildly high. So hard to laugh a child.
Welcome back to episode 97 of See Here podcast. And Bernie and I are very, very excited because we're speaking to Mr. B. Wilson. Mr. B. R. Wilson. All right. Mr. Brent Wilson. Located in Los Angeles, California, who has made a documentary about another B.R. Wilson, Brian Wilson, film called Long Promised Road. Welcome back to See Here 97, Brent.
Thank you, guys. It's great to be back with you again. And as yeah, I'd like to say it's, you know, my middle name is actually now no relation. So it's Brent Wilson. I've officially changed it. It's on my driver's license. And yes.
Oh, man. So I presume you're getting that a lot.
Absolutely. Every interview. The funniest one was Elton John. When I interviewed Elton, Elton was absolutely, he goes, are you Brian's nephew or something, or one of Carl's kids? And I go, no, I'm just coincidence. And he goes, no, man. He goes, you've even got Beach Boy hair. You've got the Beach Boy. And I took that as a very, that was a high compliment, I thought.
You weren't tempted to kind of ride that, though, Brent, and maybe say, oh, yeah, I'm kind of related to Brian, and try and push it, see how far you could get.
Absolutely. I get in a lot of restaurants now that way.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
I do not. I've tried it a couple of times, but much like Brian, I am not good at it. But I live here in the, I live a block from the ocean, and I'm in Redondo Beach, and you know, the Beach Boys and that lure of California and that myth of California was just a part of my youth. But I did. I grew up in Kentucky, Louisville, Kentucky, which is, you know, in the middle of nowhere.
A lot of good surfing over there, isn't there?
Exactly. Exactly. And I remember, all those great Beach Boys songs. And, they talk, about the girls and the cars. And you'd see the photos. And you're like, well, that looks like a pretty good place. And then there was the Jan and Dean song, what was it, Surf City, two girls for every boy.
Two girls for every boy.
First chance I got, I moved, and it was a big part of it. And ironically, we talk a little bit about it in the film. I think it's Brian had a really big influence on a lot of people moving to L.A. and chasing kind of that mythic L.A. dream. He really did create, I think, a myth that's, maybe not sometimes always true, but it certainly is one that we want to believe in.
So the last time that you came on See Here, I was joined by my friend and local doo-wop expert, Peter Merritt. Hello, Peter, if you're listening, to speak about your earlier film, Streetlight Harmonies. And listeners, if you haven't caught that film, please do so. Wonderful film, but of course I'm biased because I have a passion for doo-wop music. But now you've gone and made this film about Brian, Long Promised Road. So obviously harmonies are a strong part of your musical DNA. DNA. But I was sort of wondering, like, given that there have been so many films like Endless Harmony and the film of a few years ago, the biopic Love and Mercy, and I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, a documentary that was made by Don Was in the 90s, and probably a ton others I can't even think of at the moment. My obvious question is, why? Why would you be making another Brian Wilson film?
It's an excellent question. And those are all amazing films. And another one is David Leaf's Smile.
Yes.
Where he tracked Brian, making
Beautiful Smile. Dreamer or something like that. That was
Beautiful Dreamer. Yes, you're right. Yeah, Beautiful Dreamer. I mean, so you're right. There are incredible films. As a Brian Wilson fan, as a Beach Boy fan, it was funny. I knew all of these films, watched all these films, owned all these films. And yet somehow I still felt like I didn't know the man. I still felt like there was kind of this myth, right? There was this persona around, and I was still kind of fascinated to try to get to who was Brian Wilson. And I think the closest I had seen it, and I was really kind of inspired by, is the second half of Beautiful Dreamer, when David Leaf is actually following, it gets kind of away from the biopic of Brian, and then kind of starts, maybe for the last 30 minutes or so, start to follow Brian making the album. And I thought to myself, man, that would be incredible to see, more of that. And then when you see the movie Love and Mercy, which is a beautiful film that's just heartbreaking to watch sometimes, the film actually ends with him and Melinda reuniting. And they get back together and, you get the sense that they're going to get married. Well, since that time, Brian and Melinda did get married. They've adopted 5 children, and Brian tours like 180, dates a year. And I was at a show with the Greek Theater here in L.A., and it was I was just a fan. My wife had bought me some nice seats, right up front. Just was enjoying the show, and it was Brian's birthday. And at a certain point, they wheeled out a birthday cake. And all of Brian's kids and all of Brian's grandkids surrounded him with a piano, and the entire audience and his family and band sang happy birthday to him. And I just kind of sat there with like a little tear in my eye, thinking to myself, how in the world did this guy get to that point, where this man was surrounded by so much love? He had gone through so much hell and had endured so much. And now here he was, in his 70s, doing something he was afraid to do in his 20s, and just surrounded by love. And I thought, that's the film I want to see. That's the film I want to try to capture. So I was arrogant enough to think I could do it. I tried and failed.
Yeah, right.
I'm curious, Brent, how you just went about getting it off the ground, particularly interested in Jason Fine's involvement, because the film, in a way, seems almost like a buddy pick with him and Brian. So did you approach Jason? Did Jason approach you? How did it all kind of come together?
Thank you for noticing that, because I did. I consider it almost a buddy pick. My editor and I, Hector Lopez, we were sitting in the edit bay one day, and we kind of started talking about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Lethal Weapon and, kind of these great buddy picks, right? It was like kind of like started to kind of feel like that to us. But what had happened with Jason is I had tried a couple of times to interview Brian, and they all went pretty poorly. You see one at the very beginning of the film, which is, where, Brian tries to give an answer and he just shoots me down.
Is that something you can explain? Is that something that's even explained?
No, I can't.
And then I spend like the next 45 minutes getting the usual Brian Wilson, yes, no, I don't know. Mm. So many journalists have experienced. Then I tried another effort where I surrounded Brian at the piano. We rented out Capitol Records, put Brian down at a piano, and surrounded him with some friends and some members of the band. And I had them ask the questions. And that got a little bit better, but it was still not something that I could use. I still didn't have a film, but I saw enough of a spark. And then it was Gene Seavers, Brian's manager, who suggested, hey, why don't you talk to Jason Fine? Jason's editor at Rolling Stone. He's been covering Brian for years. and he might have some tips on how to interview Brian. Well, I went back and read one of Jason's articles called Brian Wilson's Better Days, and it describes spending a weekend with Brian, and they go to the movies, they go see the Wrecking Crew movie, they go get a massage, they go get sushi and have beers. And as I'm reading that article, I thought, you know what? That's the movie I want to see. That would be a great movie. And my partners and I, we approached Jason, and Jason made the mistake of saying, I'll do anything I can to help. And then I pitched him my crazy idea to, you know, put these cameras in a car and, you know, not have any camera operators and just let those guys drive around LA and see what we got.
It works beautifully. It's fantastic. It's a really sort of unique sort of approaching a subject and, you know, a person and drawing the stories out of him and stuff. And I think it works tremendously well.
So for the listeners who haven't seen the film yet, the film is broken up into segments of, as we've just kind of said, Brian and Jason Fine driving around parts of LA and Jason using those locations as triggers for Brian's memory to say, what do you remember about this place? What do you remember about that place? And then asking other questions. And Brian is certainly, he's hardly like a fountain at this point, but certainly, as you say, far more talkative than the monosyllabic answers that he's given other journalists. But yes, this is friends, and they're frequently saying things like,
what'd you feel like when you lived here and you were young, married, money, writing hits? What was that feeling for you?
Excitement. Exciting, happy, groovy feeling.
Hey, Jason, you're a real cool guy. You're a really nice guy.
It's so lovely, yeah. Isn't it? It's so sweet.
So that is mixed in with, I guess, more conventional sort of documentary archival footage. There was actually one moment that really surprised me in a way. I think it was from 1976. And you see Dennis and Carl, and they're talking to whoever the journalist is. And Dennis is saying something like, we remember about the stuff that the three of us would sing as kids. And my father would weep tears at how beautiful we sounded. It was so touching to him. I mean, from all that we know, obviously, you know, Murray was not the greatest of fathers, but more the point that particularly out of the three brothers, Dennis's relationship with Murray was the most arduous. I don't know if he actually punched his father out, or at least threatened to punch his father out. It was very, very fracturous. And the fact is, like, at this point, in front of the journalist, though, he's making out like, oh, yeah, all was nice, and our father heard us, and how sweet it was. So do you know, at that time, in like in the mid-70s, was it not common knowledge to the music listening public about how bad Murray had been to the brothers?
It wasn't. No. At that point, it wasn't. And you made a really great observation, Maurice, because of all the relationships with the interviews that I did. And I, of course, I touch on it a little bit, but I didn't go down the path as much as I could have. But Dennis was probably the closest with Murray. They told me stories of how Murray and Dennis would watch boxing on Friday nights. Dennis would go over to the house and watch boxing matches. And they actually had the closest relationship. But at the same time, Dennis was the one that probably took the toughest licks from Murray. Because as you can imagine, Dennis was probably the one that was probably going, screw you. And, you know, getting his dad to hit him harder. You can absolutely see Dennis standing up to Murray. So in some ways, I think he got it the hardest from him. In some ways, he was the closest with him and or sought out that love the most. And the biggest surprise for me as the filmmaker doing this film was how much Brian wanted to talk about his brothers. I never imagined that was going to happen. And Jason and I, we discussed really early on that we kind of took what we called a Hippocratic oath. We were never going to do any harm. If Brian didn't want to talk about something, we weren't going to talk about it. If Brian didn't want to go visit a location, we didn't go visit it. It was just, we never wanted to hurt Brian. And that was, and so I assumed that we weren't going to get that much about Carl and Dennis. And Brian just spends so much time talking so lovingly about his brothers. And Jason and I have talked about it, and we want to believe that he just, of course, you know, Brian's a kid of the 50s and a very macho father. And he'd ever said, I love you, to your brothers. And they all came in very complicated relationships, you know, as business partners and as brothers. And I just kind of felt like maybe Brian was trying to say something to Carl and Dennis that he never had the chance to say to him. And he talks about what wonderful producers they are. He talks about how much he misses them and how much he loves them. And it became as much a film about the boys as it does, I think, it does Brian. And that was something I was really surprised by. I didn't expect that.
I think it was amazing that you were able to, you were lucky enough to kind of catch Brian listening to Pacific Ocean Blue, not having heard it before, saying, oh yeah, I never got around to listening to it. And to see him and Jason sat there listening to that, and just the expression on Brian's face and his eyes, that was just pure magic. It was such an amazing thing, such a privilege to be able to capture that.
It was incredible. I just, standing behind the camera operator, Max, my DP, just standing behind him and witnessing it is just a person standing there was like one of those moments I'll never forget, because you can see the pride on Brian's face, right? You can really see him. He's listening as a producer, and he's like, good. You know, he's so proud of him. And yeah, that was a moment that we didn't expect. As a matter of fact, I told our DP Max, we went back to the house. He asked to hear it. We went into the house and I told Max to say, hey, look, man, he wants to hear it now. Let's not bring in a lot of lights. Let's not bring in a tripod. I want to keep the mood going. I don't want to take 30 minutes to reset and all that stuff, so that we can just, I want to keep the emotion and the vibe going. I said, don't even bother bringing in a tripod, because I don't think this is going to last 5 minutes. I think he's going to get 2 minutes into this song, into this, and then it's going to be too much and we're going to shut it down. And poor Max stood there for an hour with that camera on his shoulder, because Brian listened to every second of that whole album. And it was a beautiful moment, beautiful moment.
That's a real hair standing up on the back of your neck moment, wasn't it?
Just absolutely tremendous.
I got to confess, you know, when he said, nope, never heard Pacific Ocean Blue. Nope, never heard the album. And I was incredible. And like Jason, what came out of Jason's mouth is exactly what came out of my mouth while watching that. Because what? Not even the River song.
Exactly.
That album is sort of like what Elvis Costello did, a song called The Other Side of Summer, and it was like his answer to the whole Beach Boys mythos of sun and surf and cars and everything being perfect. But he's saying, well, there's a dark side to summer. And to me, Pacific Ocean Blue was like that one song, what Elvis Costello did later, but put into a whole album form. That album is dark. It's not something that Brian could ever have done. It's musically dark, thematically dark in points. I mean, I can imagine Brian being proud of what Dennis had achieved with that album. But did he ever actually sort of say to you, wow, this music is great, you know, this song appeals to me, that song appeals to me? Did he talk like off camera later on about specific songs that appealed to him?
Not specifically. Again, I think he was really listening. I got the impression that he was listening as a producer, right? Like he would pick out specific moments where maybe there would be a chord change and you would see him nod his head, you know? So I got the impression that he was listening as a producer. And because I think in his heart, that's what Brian always wanted to be, just the producer, right? He never wanted to be the singer. He never wanted to be the guy out front. And he always wanted to be, you know, just that guy behind the board. Nobody taught Dennis how to play piano. You know, nobody taught Dennis how to sing. He did it. He was all self-taught. And, you know, for even casual Beach Boy fans, I mean, Forever is a stunning Beach Boy song. If every word I said I'd talk forever. I asked the sky just what we had. It shone forever. That is all Dennis. If you like Forever, then yeah, you've got to listen to Pacific Ocean Blue. And I was really honored, of course, and just so blessed and so fortunate to have Taylor Hawkins. It's Taylor Hawkins' favorite album. And he, you know, Taylor really loved Dennis. And it just breaks my heart that we just did a press release where the show is going to film here and is going to air here on PBS here in the United States, a public broadcasting. And the press release said the late Taylor Hawkins. And it just broke my heart because I think he got that Dennis wasn't the fuck up that everybody thought he was, you know, that Dennis was an artist. And I know that Brian thought it too, right? I think, you know, everybody, there's the rumor that he was going to call Smile was a dumb angel, you know, after Dennis, just, you know, it was just his dumb little brother. And he just, I think, more than specifically identifying with anything, it was just being proud. The fact that, you know, his dumb little brother created this incredible album, and he was shocked to hear it.
It was interesting, like, whenever it was 15 years ago when they finally did a really lovely re-release of Pacific Ocean Blue, they put out a second disc with what would have been Dennis's second album, but they never released. And at the end of that is Taylor Hawkins doing his version of Holy Man. Like his voice, that lived-in, scratchy voice that sounds like Dennis sang.
He was like Dennis incarnate, wasn't he? And he showed up at the interview in his board shorts and his tank top. And he looked like he just came from surfing. There was a little bit of Dennis Wilson DNA in Taylor. And I think he recognized it and knew it, appreciated that as a drummer, he had those artistic aspirations. And some of the things that he talks about in the film are just so beautiful. He gives such beautiful answers. I was really surprised because, you know, the impression that I had of Taylor was like the goofball drummer, right? The high energy, just, you know, always goofing off drummer. And he just gave some incredibly beautiful answers. And I'm really, really, really proud that he's in the film, and I miss him. I texted with him in December and told him the film was done, and he goes, "Did I make the cut?" Like, what do you mean, did I make the cut? That was his question. Did I make the cut? And I'm like, yeah, dude, you made the cut. Yeah, we got to give more credit to those drummers.
Yes.
Sure, yeah.
Isn't that right, Bernie?
We're both retired drummers. I don't know if you're retired, Morris, but I haven't played for a long time, but in my youth I did.
So maybe we'll do a Doc, Dennis, Taylor, Levon Helm. Who else? Don Henley.
Morris and Bernie.
Yes. Morris and Bernie.
Yeah. Give the drummer some, yeah.
Book us in. You and Jason took the Hippocratic Oath, but when Brian and Melinda would have signed on, say, yep, we agree to let this happen, was there anything that they said, or I guess maybe particularly Melinda, you know, being the one who lives with them, would say, look, don't go there, don't go to this place, whatever you do, don't bring up Mike Love, whatever. Was there anything that they said, we trust you to work it out, or did they say in advance, please make sure that you don't go to these places?
Yeah, no, they never said a word. As a filmmaker, I could never give an artist final cut. I could never give them say, because then it becomes a PR piece. I don't want to do that, and that's not fair to the fans. It doesn't do any good for the artist. It doesn't do any good for the fans. So they didn't have final cut. But you are nervous when they see the film. You know, there are some very sensitive areas, and you know, and some very deep moments. And you do get nervous that they are going to say something, and they're not going to be pleased. But fortunately, there wasn't anything. They love the film. The kids, Brian's kids, love the film. I had their kids come up to me at a screening at the Grammy Museum, And I've gotten to know the kids really well and came up and gave me a hug and said, thank you for showing our father for who he really is. And so I think more than anything, I think Melinda and the kids just appreciated the fact that you see all of Bryant. You know, you get those moments of brilliance. You see the everyday pain that he goes through. I mean, Bryant struggles every day of his life with the schizophrenia, the voices in his head, with the fear, you know, with those pains. It is a daily battle that never goes away. And yet every day he finds a way to try and live and try and carry on. And some days are better than others. And some days are great. And I think we capture a little bit of both. And I think that was one of the goals I wanted for the film, is that I heard that from a lot of fans, that a lot of fans would say, Brian gives me strength. If Brian Wilson can do this, I can do this. You know, I heard that from a lot of fans. And so I wanted that to come through because he's terrified. You know, you see it, you know, he gets scared in the deli, which he's been to 1,000 times. You know, he talks about getting nervous and being scared to going in to record in the studio with his band that he loves, that he's done 1,000 times, and yet he gets scared. And it's just that way for him every day. And yet he finds a way to carry on. And so I think they appreciated the fact that we showed both sides. But I was nervous. You know, I didn't want them to not like the film. I wanted them to be proud of the film, too. And fortunately, they are.
It's interesting. So you bring up there the moment of him going into the studio. And Bernie and I are both of a similar mind, where we have a problem with a lot of scripted biopics because it tends to avoid the music and just sort of only sort of go superficially into the music, but it's more about what happens, you know, in the back, all the demon fighting and all that sort of thing. And one thing that I'm pretty sure we both loved about Love and Mercy was that whole scene where Paul Dano, who is superb, he really inhabited Brian, is in the studio talking to the musicians, talking that bit with Carol Kay. Oh, I notice that the cellos are playing this root note and I'm playing this. Does it work? Oh, yeah, it works in my head. Yeah, give it a try. And he's king of the studio. And you show in your film, it's almost like you sort of think studio bit, because the whole thing is we as music fans, we want to know, show us a creative process. Show us something about what makes us love him musically in the first place. You go from that moment where he's saying, yeah, I'm nervous, Jason, I'm nervous. And he says, don't worry, you'll crush this.
I'm nervous.
It's like you say when you go on stage, nervous for about 2 minutes.
Right. And then as soon as I hear California Girls, I'm cool.
You got this.
And then he walks in the studio and all of a sudden he's the king. He's saying to the drummer, no, start off with this pattern. Saying to the saxophone player, no, you haven't quite got that right. Do it like this. And he's king of the studio just on this little bit. And Darian Sahanaja, you know, when Brian is saying, oh, I think I'll go to the piano, he says, yeah, now we're talking. That bit of enthusiasm. And Brian just kills it. I love that studio moment. Was there ever any time where Brian had said, no, the studio is my private domain. I don't want to show you that. Because the film would have been a very different film without that bit where showing him performing Honeycomb. But with it just really sparkles. I love that moment.
Thank you. No, and I'm like you guys. I want to see the creative process. And I hate music documentaries that don't have music in them. You know what I mean? They don't have enough music. We cleared 50 some odd songs, I think, for this film, which is a lot for a music documentary. It's half our budget is just clearing music. Right. But it's important because how do you do a music without the music?
Well, you had a lot of music to clear for Streetlight Harmonies as well, didn't you?
The exact same thing for Streetlight Harmonies. Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's a credo to me. It's a mantra. It's like, how do you have a music doc and not have as much music as you can possibly squeeze in? So we cleared a lot of songs, and the songs that Brian plays and, you know, the songs that he picks in the car. But when it came to the studio, so Brian's not working on an album or anything, but I wanted to see that creative process. I felt it was important. How do I talk about Brian Wilson being a genius if I can't show him being a genius? And so I was very fortunate that our producers agreed to finance Brian recording. And The other thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to see Brian recording as if he had recorded in 65 or 66, which is the whole band in the room, right? Nobody does that anymore. As a matter of fact, you'll hear at the very beginning of the scene, very small in the background, you'll hear Blondie Chaplin go, "It's about time we recorded like this." Because nobody, it's too expensive. You know, you can't rent these big studios. You can't fly in, you know, 12 musicians, put them up at hotels. You just record them one at a time into Pro Tools, or you pull some sample out of Pro Tools. And that's how albums are made these days. Nobody does it like this. But I wanted to try very hard to see what that interaction was like between Brian and his band in the studio. And Wes, Brian's engineer, who's a longtime engineer, and you know, you see that room that we're in, it's Frank Sinatra's studio. You see that room, it's a huge room and it's a huge board. And Wes said we maxed out every channel on that board. And I think it's, you know, I don't know, 86 channels or whatever it was, and every one of them was maxed out. Everybody was mic'd live. Count them off, 1, 2, 3, 4, and the band records. That's what I wanted to see, because I wanted to see if Brian had those interactive moments, would that spark the creative process? And I told Brian, I said, "Brian, you record whatever you want to record. There is no agenda here." So he wanted to record Honeycomb. I've never even heard of Honeycomb.
Well, it's darn good life, and it's kind of funny how the Lord made the bee, and the bee made the honey. The honey bee looking for a home. Called it honeycomb, and they roamed the world, and they gathered all of the honeycomb into one sweet ball, and the honeycomb.
And it's who is it that sings the original?
Jimmy Rogers.
Jimmy Rogers. Yeah. So he said, "I want to record this Jimmy Rogers song, Honeycomb." And I left his house, and I pulled it up on my phone, and I'm like, "What the hell is this song?" It's such a, you know, his Brian's version is, but you listen to the Jimmy Rogers version, it's just this kind of little sweet, I don't know, kind of really poppy tune. Of course, Brian does amazing things with it, but I'm like, why does he want to do this song? And he wanted to do Long Promise Road. He wanted to do Johnny B. Good. For some strange reason, he wanted to do Little Honda. And I'm like, I don't care. You know, I'm like, you record whatever you want to record. And the band is here for you. The studio is here for you. The engineer is here for you. And we'll record whatever you want as long as you want. And so all of that to say was because I wanted to see if we could capture that creative process. And what you see there with that scene in Honeycomb is nearly real time. He comes in, sets down, starts dish. He doesn't even say hi, right? If you notice in the film, he starts dishing out parts and teaching everything to everybody. Then he sets down at the piano. Then he starts saying hi to everybody. He's so focused the second that he gets in there. And then the way he's directing Paul Mertens, a saxophone player, it was just amazing to watch how he came to life and brought that song to life. And what you hear is what you get. That is, we very little cut down on that. I think they did like 3 takes of it, and then Brian was happy, and I was thrilled to death. There was a moment where I was standing back, and I'm behind the camera operator, and everybody's recording, and David Calcano, who's our art director, and did all of our graphics with us, and he's standing over here beside me. And I'm standing back there and I'm watching Brian record this song and direct this band. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, this is exactly how we did it in 65. You know, I am witnessing something that very few people get to witness. This is a remarkable moment in my life just to be able to sit here and witness this. And I started to tear up a little bit, but the whole crew's around me, right? Grips and everything. And so I got to kind of do one of those fake, you know, kind of, you know, like I got something in my eyes so that, you know, kind of get that tear in my eye. And as I do that, I look over and David Calcano, the art director, has just got tears streaming down his face.
I was going to say, I'm sure you weren't the only person feeling that way, yeah, in that room.
Exactly. So, yeah. This tough grip is over on the ladder, and he's choked up. And it was just a beautiful moment to see Brian do you know, what he does and what God put him on this earth to do and do it so well and enjoy it so much.
You don't put it at the end of the film exactly, but it's sort of like a bookend, because at the beginning of the film, you show something what is presumably from like a Good Vibrations sessions, the archival footage, you know, what they recreate in Love and Mercy. This is who Brian was back then, and this at his core is who he is, who he still is.
That was the exact intention. Yeah, that was the exact intention, was to really almost kind of, I didn't want to put it at the end because I wanted you to see it in the middle, but conceptually that was the idea. I wanted you to see Brian at the beginning in his prime, and then I wanted you to see Brian at 78 still trying to do exactly what he did, you know, at 25 years old, you know, and now at 75 and doing it pretty damn well. It's a great song. We did put out a soundtrack with, I think we cut and mixed 5 or 6 songs from that session. And I was like, you know, we got to put a soundtrack out. You know, I was like, we got to put these 5 songs out as a fan, and I got to hear this. And so I'm really proud of giving Brian that freedom to just do what you want to do, and very thankful to our producers for allowing us that, you know, that opportunity to do that, because it's not the cheapest thing to do. They just sit down now and pull something out of Pro Tools and call it a day. Not as much fun.
Well, you had the great Caroline note. It's one of the greatest songs in pop history, as far as dealing with oncoming adulthood, loss of innocence, reckoning with the adult world, and the terrible heartache that comes along with it.
I wanted to ask you, Brent, you've got a number of people in the film, you know, some very big names, famous, renowned people. You have Elton John, and you've got Bruce Springsteen, Don Was is in there. Did you have to approach these people? Were they approaching you? Were there people that you would have liked to perhaps have brought in to speak to who you weren't able to?
We reached out to all of them, and nobody said no. Well, there was a couple of people that said no first for scheduling reasons.
Sure.
But the people that we reached out to, I didn't want a lot of talking heads, but what I wanted was a very unique list of talking heads. I wanted different genres, right? So I wanted, you know, so Bruce Springsteen is an American icon, right? Nick Jonas is 25 and he's an icon to, you know, to 20-year-olds and to 25-year-olds. And Elton John is a British and international icon. And then Gustavo Dudamel is the world's foremost conductor, and he's the head of the LA Philharmonic and the Paris Opera. Jim James is the king of indie rock, right? Mm-hmm. He's the banner that carries the banner for the Grateful Dead and that genre of rock. And so the idea that I kind of wanted to have was, as if you're flipping the channel and you saw Bruce Springsteen and Nick Jonas and, you know, Jim James together, you'd go, what in the hell do these guys have in common? And the only thing they could have in common is their love for Brian Wilson. So that was the idea. And so I wanted just this really diverse, fun list. The one that got away, the one that I really wanted, and we just couldn't get it, was Bono. And the reason that I wanted Bono, we even told his management, but he was just, of course, you know, Bono's just one of the busiest guys in the world. But there was a story that I was told by his band that if I could just get Bono to tell that story, then I would have done, you know, the interview would have been done. I just wanted 5 minutes with him to tell this story that Darian has told me and all the guys in the band. Since we didn't get Bono, I'll tell you the story. So Ryan and the band were playing a charity event, and Bono was playing it, U2 was playing it as well. And as you see in the film, you know, Brian, every once in a while, you'll see Brian like in his leather recliner by the side of the stage. You know, that's his world, right? They fly this recliner, this chair around, and he sits. He never goes to his dressing room. And Brian sits in his chair and, you know, he waits for the show to start and the world kind of, that's his little domain. And you'll find him there from the minute he arrives until it's showtime. I guess U2 was coming in and they were doing their sound check, and Brian was sitting down in his leather recliner, and Bono walks over and kneels down at the recliner so that he's eye to eye with Brian. So Bono's on his knees and he tells Brian, "I am a huge fan of yours. Your music has meant the world to me, and it is just an honor to meet you. And if there's anything I could ever do for you, please let me know. And Brian goes, well, I could use a Diet Coke. And Bono got up and got him a Diet Coke.
Oh, amazing. Wow.
And I wanted Bono to tell that story, and I couldn't get it.
Wow.
Any possibility you can get hold of him now and put it as a bonus feature on the DVD?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Bono, if you're listening, give us a call. We're going to add it as an extra on the DVD.
I'm sure Bono is listening to See Here. Isn't that right, Bernie?
I guarantee he is.
Oh, and there in those guys. I swear to God, Brent, he got up and got the Diet Coke. Well, that was the only one that we didn't get that I would love to have had.
Well, as I say, you did pretty good anyway, Brent. That's a heck of a lineup.
And, you know, and those guys were all so elegant in the way they spoke. Don is a producer. The way he breaks down, you know, God only knows.
I tell you, the scene where he's playing the isolated vocal tracks, the harmonies, it's akin to a religious experience, isn't it? It just stopped me in my tracks watching. You know, I know the song incredibly well. I know Pet Sounds. You cannot know the song, but just to hear that in its purest form, it's just breathtaking. It's breathtaking. That,
you know, it's one of those just, you're so kismet, right? Just, you know, good karma. Is, you know, my camera operator's literally panning up as Don hits the button and isolates the track. And he's panning up and he captures Don's face. And his eyes get big and his head shakes. And he just
has faking that, is there? It's that was a tremendous moment. That was great.
One of those good karma moments where the camera operator's doing exactly that thing. And when Don Was says, I don't know how you do this. That's a compliment.
Yeah.
I thought Bruce, I love Bruce's takes. You know, Bruce brought just so much, I think, just understanding of the emotional aspects of Brian's songs. And then what I loved about Elton is Elton brought understanding of the technical aspects of Brian's songs. Like when Elton talks about he uses the fifth note of something, and that's the exact thing I use on, you know, some song. I have no idea what he's talking about. But I know that's important to musicians, right? Mm-hmm. I know that's important to people who understand that. And Bruce understood the emotional aspect of it. And so I thought there was a great dichotomy there. And then interestingly enough, I thought, you know, Nick Jonas, I was trying to find somebody. I caught a lot of hell for putting Nick in the film. I saw on the boards, you know, people like, oh, my God, I can't believe Nick Jonas is in this film. What are they doing? And I caught a lot of shit. And I kept telling people, just wait until you see the film. Because what I was trying to do with Nick was I was trying to find somebody, anybody who could understand what Brian went through. And it occurred to me it was Nick Jonas, right? So here was Nick, who as a teenager, 18, 19 years old, was in a group with his brothers making pop music that was unbelievably successful. And then as he got into his 20s, wanted to get away from that pop music and make a more sophisticated sound, a more adult sound that wasn't being received as well by the fans and certainly wasn't being received well by the labels. And then feeling the pressure to try to kind of recapture all of that. I thought, God, that's exactly what Brian did. And, you know, and Nick was talking about his brothers, you know, going, no, that's when Nick went solo for a while because his brothers were like, no, we got to stick to what works. And I'm like, Jesus, that's exactly what, you know, happened with Brian. And so I was really happy that we were able to get his perspective. And when he talks about the pressure of satisfying a label and satisfying your bandmates, I think he gets it. He understood it as well as anyone. And then Linda Perry, another amazing producer who just anytime you can get that kind of insight into the music, I think as a fan, I enjoy that. I like that. I call it inside baseball, right? Like,
sure,
you know, we're talking that inside baseball talk. I may not quite know what they're talking about, but I think it's cool.
The one thing you capture with all of them, the one thing they gave you is they're all fans. And you said, you know, these are people that have sold millions of records and they're household names and everybody knows them. And you get to see them being fans and talking about an artist they love and totally geeking out. And that's just great as well. That really comes across well.
Thank you. Because I geek out too, right? Like we geek out, right? I mean, you're with your buddies. And you geek out about music and you geek out about songs. And I thought it would be kind of cool to see Elton John and Bruce Springsteen geeking out. You know, I just thought that would be kind of fun. Make them more identifiable and more relatable. And I like that. I like it when they geek out. And because that's what me and my buddies do. You know, we geek out about stuff. And so it's cool that they do too.
A few years ago for my other podcast, I had the chance to interview Darian Sahanaja. It was actually on Brian Wilson's 50th anniversary of Pet Sounds tour, and he came to Australia. So I was thrilled to be able to speak to Darian. And he told me a story about when he was a kid that he was, I think, walking home one day from the record shop or from school or wherever, and he had a copy of Endless Summer under his arm. And he was beaten up by local kids in his street because, you know, you like the Beach Boys, that shit. It seemed to be symptomatic. I don't know anyone else who was beaten up for who they like, but it was definitely a thing that, and it's like, commonly spoken about in the biographies and all that, that for a time in the 70s and going into the 80s, the Beach Boys were desperately unfashionable. You know, they had the 5-6 years of solid fandom in the 60s, and then it was like not just we've lost interest, it was actually embarrassing to say that you're a fan of the Beach Boys, putting aside, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, the abomination that is Kokomo, but that had nothing to do with Brian. But insofar as Brian's own resurgence, and it is a huge resurgence, I like to sort of put it back to Don Was's documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. It was basically saying, right, here I am, I'm married to this beautiful woman, I'm making music, I'm going to revisit a few old songs, and then I'm going to keep moving forward. Now, all of a sudden, it's like all the love that comes out. There was a live album that he recorded in front of famous fans, I think. I don't know if it was at the Old Greek, but certainly in Los Angeles. The Roxy. The Roxy.
The Roxy. Yeah, the Roxy.
And so, like, all of a sudden, unlike a lot of legacy artists, I mean, okay, there are some legacy artists, they still do what, you know, the old hits, but really, it seems like Brian is absolutely huge in a way that a lot of other people from that period couldn't have this second act in their life. So this is speculation, but where do you think it is that the fans, people sort of came out and said, wow, this is actually really, really great. Where do you think that he got that second act?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it was Don Was's film. I think it just wasn't made for these times. And it was that film and that album that kind of brought a credibility to Brian, and it brought a coolness to Brian that had been, you know, that had been missing for a long time. And you know, look, I was just like Darian. You know, I was shocked. Kids were listening to Van Halen's 1984 and they were not listening to the Beach Boys instead. It was like, you know, I was that guy. I was, you know, I saw my first Beach Boy concert at 10. I thought it was the greatest experience in the world. And I was shocked that every kid in school didn't love the Beach Boys. It was like, what do you mean all of the Beach Boys? It's the greatest band in the world. Who the fuck is Van Halen? What is that? You know? So I didn't get beat up, but I probably would have gotten beat up if I carried my albums in. So I know exactly what Darian is talking about. It was not cool in those early 80s to be a fan. And Jason Fine talks about this. Jason, he loved the Beach Boys as a kid, but then as a teenager, you know, he got into punk rock and all that stuff. And then he, you know, went to work, I think, for Rolling Stone, and he saw the Don Was film, and it made him go back and re-examine Brian again. And so I do. I think there was an element of that. And one of the things that I wanted to try to capture and try to do, and an inspiration for me was Johnny Cash and what Johnny Cash was doing in the third act of his life, right? You see him still trying. You see him still recording.
American recordings.
You see him, exactly. That whole American recordings renaissance that happened with Johnny Cash. And that was an inspiration for me and Jason. We talked about that a lot, that, you know, Brian is having very much this, maybe not as focused as what was happening with Johnny, but certainly of that level. And when we shot a show at the Ryman, you know, the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville or something, I mean, it's just hipster central. That's the audience, and that's awesome to see. That's what you want, is you want that next generation of fans to come to recognize this music. And I'm really proud that we were able to capture this act in Brian's life, and for people to see that he can play the Hollywood Bowl, you know, with 20,000 people, and Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be there, but yet there's going to be, you know, Jim James, and, you know, and you're going to just get this incredible mix of people who are going to understand that this is a true artist still making great music. And I'm proud that we're just a small thread in Brian's story.
So to that point, one thing that I did notice as an absence from the film was there wasn't really any talk, well, much talk about albums like No Peer Pressure and Orange Crate Art or That Lucky Old Sun. Did Brian sort of not want to talk about those albums? Or where does he stand on like his latter-day Renaissance albums? Does he ever talk about that?
I think there's three songs from Lucky Old Sun. Like Midnight's Another Day, Southern California, and there might be a third song. Like I cleared like three songs from that album. I love that album. I think it's an incredible album. But what happened was and Brian, you know, Brian selects the songs. He really likes that album too. You should go get The Lucky Old Son. But there's some really good documentaries on the making of the albums. They're pretty recent, and you know, they're pretty available, and they're really well-made films. I'd rather maybe see a little more time in the car, or you know, maybe see a little more time in the studio now. And so you try to kind of find the balance, make those choices. I had somebody come up to me in Nashville. I don't know if he was joking or not, but he scared the shit out of me because he was like, I don't know how you make a Brian Wilson film and leave out Sloop John B. And like, you know, he was like this close. It's like, and he's right. You know, it's criminal the songs that we left out because there's just so many amazing songs and so much amazing work that Brian's done. But it just kind of comes down to choices, and I wanted to make the film a link that it could be enjoyed by a general audience, right? Like, I'm a Brian Wilson fan. I'm going to show up and watch this movie no matter what, right? It could have been 3 hours long. It could have been 20 minutes long. It could have been shit. It could have been brilliant. I'm going to watch it because I'm a Brian Wilson fan. I want to see what it is. But I never felt like I needed to get me as a fan. What I wanted to try to capture was maybe somebody who knows Good Vibrations, you know, has heard Help Me Rhonda, has heard God Only Knows in a trailer for a Pixar movie, which, you know, just happened. And they go, oh, I like that song. I'll watch this documentary. And then they come to understand the artist. And so I think to kind of reach that audience, you've got to make a film that can retain them. So that was kind of a goal going in. So I want to kind of keep it at that hour 30, you know, level. But I could have made a 2.5 hour film easy. I think my first cut was 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Can we see that version, Brent?
Absolutely.
The director's cut.
Born between two oceans, it took a great notion, hitchhike all across this land. Raised on funky Broadway, I came up the hard way. Come on, fellas, strike up the band.
The thing that the film does refer to and that a lot of people refer to as being the masterpiece of the time that wasn't appreciated, Pet Sounds, and the masterpiece that eventually saw the light of day in Smile. But I think a lot of hardcore fans, which people like us would appreciate, is that, well, hell, you really need to be listening to albums like Sunflower, and you need to hear Surf's Up, and you need to hear Holland and the like. So my question to you is, if you were to take Good Vibrations and the greatest hits and Pet Sounds and Smile out of the picture, what's an album or a song, what's a favorite moment for you outside of the obvious, a deep cut or an album from the 70s, even not necessarily something that involved Brian that much?
And there are so many songs that just killed me to cut, but you're right, Sunflower and Friends are just astounding, right? I mean, they're just remarkable works. The Kiss Me Baby, I tried so hard to get that song in. I wasn't really familiar with that song. I even asked Brian, why did that song not do well? And he goes, it was in this string of like 19 top 10 songs. And it just kind of got lost. And it was like, it was stunning. It was a couple of songs from Holland, Steamboat, that I tried to get in. There is a period there from the early 70s, I think, that is pretty remarkable. I did get in, like I said, Brian, of course, selects Long Promise Road. Brian's the one that's picking the songs. And he asked to hear Trigger. And he asked to hear Long Promise Road. And The Night Was So Young.
The night was so young. Everything still, moon shining bright on my window sill. I think of her lip, it chills me inside. And then I think, why does she have to hide?
Is somebody gonna tell me why she had to hide?
He kept asking to hear, and I wasn't particularly, I'd heard it, but didn't think too much of it. And then the other one that completely changed my perspective was, as he does in the film, he kept asking to hear It's Okay. In the movie, he asks to hear it twice, but over the 70 hours that we recorded, he probably asked to hear it 10 times. So I went back and like, well, shit, if Brian's asking to hear It's Okay this many times, I need to go back and listen to it again, get it. And then as you listen to it again, now knowing that Brian loves it, it gives you a greater appreciation for the song. And it's how, you know, the vocal trade-offs between he and Mike, you know, the lyrics that I think he uses as a mantra, gotta go to it, gotta push through it. And as you see in the film, he uses that song when he starts to kind of feel troubled and he starts to get scared, and he uses it as a mantra. And so, you know, so that's a cool song that, you know, probably most fans like me, you know, maybe you've heard it, but, you know, I maybe didn't think too much about it.
Fun is in, it's no sin, it's that time again to shed your load, hit the road on the run again. Summer skies in our eyes and a warmer sun. It's one for all for one, all for all that fun.
Gotta go through it. Gotta go through it.
And it means the world to Brian. And the other one was, yeah, Night Was So Young and Long Promise Road. He just kept asking to hear those songs over and over again. Busy Doing Nothing. I mean, that's funny, you know. So I did. I tried to kind of mix in. I wanted to have those moments where, you know, we can tip the hat to the, you know, to the real fans, and then also, you know, get the good vibrations and the God Only Knows and those in there as well. You got to try to, what I wanted to try to find that balance. Pet Sounds is talked about so much, and our producers and we talked about it. It was like, you know what, as much as it's discussed, and, you know, it's Rolling Stones, you know, Rolling Stone does their list, you know, every like 10 years or so of greatest albums. And they did it 10 years ago, and Sgt. Pepper's was number one and Pet Sounds was number two. Then they redid it last year. They updated the list, and Marvin Gaye's What's Going On was number one, but Pet Sounds was still number two.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, it's that whole top 10. If you compare the one they did 10 years ago to the one they did now, the whole top 10 is completely different, except for the number two album, which is Pet Sounds. And so we did I felt like we had to do a section on Pet Sounds just for, you know, because people do love it, and for good reason. And, you know, when Springsteen talks about Caroline No, and Brian sings Caroline No, I wanted to do Caroline No live. We captured him at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
And I loved hearing the voice of a 75-year-old singing that song now, almost looking back on love instead of looking forward to love and present in love. It was much more painful to hear him sing it now. And so that's why I chose to use the live version instead of the studio version. It just felt deeper to me. And I love the fact, too, that in the film he still talks about, he's shocked that God Only Knows gets a standing ovation every time. He says that. He goes, people stand up every time. He's still surprised by it.
And in some of the live footage he used, he says, "Thank you very much. Please sit down."
Please be seated.
Yeah.
One of my prized possessions that I got from the crew is I've got a T-shirt that says, "God only knows." And then on the back, "Please sit down." That was a shirt that the crew made for themselves, only for themselves, and they gave me one. Please sit down. Because it
so cool.
freaks him out. It makes him nervous when people, he doesn't know how to receive that love. He's better at it now. He's much better at it than he's ever been. But at the end of the day,
still
not comfortable receiving love. And I think when he says, "Please sit down," it's because of that. You know, he's just...
Yeah.
And you can see him
embarrassed almost, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. He's embarrassed.
Yeah.
I've seen him in concert 20 times. And the second that song is finished, "Please sit down." "Thank you very much. Please sit down." Every time. So no, there's nothing wrong with, it can never get enough attention and enough love. Cameron Crowe did some work with us, and he did some panels with us here in LA. And of course, you know, Cameron with Almost Famous is a huge Brian Wilson fan. We were so honored that Cameron watched the film and gave us his thoughts. And he interviewed Jason and I for some Oscar panels here in LA. And he points out, if you're a fan of music, I think, you know, Almost Famous has always got to be one of your favorite films.
Sure.
And Cameron points out, when William receives the albums, when his sister says, "Go look under your bed, it'll free your soul." And he goes and he looks under his bed and he pulls out her stacks of albums. Those are all Cameron's albums that he brought from home. And the first album, the album on the very top, is Pet Sounds.
Exactly. Cameron, right. Yeah.
Exactly. That says it all. That says all.
Which would say a lot, because at that time, it wasn't anyone's favorite album.
Exactly. Yeah, it just wasn't received well, and it was just a little too much, a little too ahead of its time, which I think is kind of, you know, was Brian's story, right? It was always just a little ahead of its time, and it just, so, you know, first listen, you would go, "Man, what is that?" And then, you know, if you do it a second, a third time, and then you go, "Okay, now I know what's going on here."
When you premiered Smile, how'd you feel? I mean, it must have been a big relief.
Well, it was a big challenge to try to pull it off, you know?
Right.
But we did. We went over very well.
The nice thing that has probably been for Brian in recent years, he's got this new group of musicians. I mean, comparatively new, they've been there for 20 years, but in a couple of links to his early days, you've already gone and mentioned Blondie Chaplin, and God, I would have liked to have seen Ricky Fattah as part of that lineup as well. Just one of my favorite drummers, but also Al Jardine being part of his. Mm-hmm. When I saw him do the Pet Sounds thing a few years ago, Blondie Chaplin was, he sang Sail on Sail, and I can't remember what other song, but it's almost like he thought he was at a Rolling Stones tribute show, because he was playing the real rock star.
Just ripping it. Yes, absolutely. That is Blondie, isn't it?
Blondie and Ricky were only like there for maybe about 3 years or something, like 2-3 years, but they're on that live album, The Beach Boys in Concert, which I have to say is one of my favorite live albums, period. The Beach Boys sound like a rock group, like a rock band.
Incredible live album for anybody who hasn't heard it. It's incredible.
A large chunk of that is because of Blondie and Ricky, I'm convinced.
Absolutely.
I think I read the story that the reason that they got them on board, well, particularly Ricky, was because Dennis, in a moment of anger, had gone and put his fist through a window and couldn't drum for a year, so he was just sitting behind the piano. That got them that live album, and they did Holland, and this song, which has got nothing to do with Brian, but a song called Leaving This Town.
Leaving This Town
is one of my favorite Beach Boys songs, and it's got nothing to do with Brian.
In the film and on the soundtrack, which I absolutely love, and it was Brian's idea, they sing Long Promise Road, and it's Blondie sings the lead. He sings the Carl part, and then Jim James comes in for a little bit, and then Brian always sings a tiny bit of just the chorus. But it's all Blondie, and he just still kind of brings that rock vibe to it. And I asked Paul, "Hey, how did you guys get Blondie?" back, because that was the same thing. It's like he's, you know, there was a very short window in the 70s, and it's not something you would think like an obvious idea, like, oh, let's get Blondie Chaplin to tour with Brian. And it was Brian's idea. Brian was like, hey, what's Blondie up to? And, you know, and that's kind of how Brian works, right? It's just like, anybody seen Blondie? What's Blondie doing? And the next thing you know, he's back out on tour with Brian. And I think he's been out on tour with him now for 8-9 years or so. And it was Brian just, I asked Paul, I was like, how does that happen? He goes, where's Blondie? Anybody seen Blondie? What's Blondie doing?
That's a great story.
And they just get him out there. But yeah, he does. It's an incredible band. Bruce talks about it in the film, and he says it, I'm paraphrasing Bruce. He thought when he saw Brian and the band doing Pet Sounds, he says in the film, I thought they were rolling tapes. And he goes, I swear to God, I thought they were rolling tapes. And then I go backstage and I talk to the band and I realize they're not. That band is playing that album with so much love and so much passion that it just blew Bruce Springsteen away how great that band sounds. I was so proud to have that clip in the film just for Brian's band. I wanted those guys to know, hey man, Bruce Springsteen thinks you guys kick ass. And if you get a chance to see Brian Wilson, you're going to hear an amazing band. And they're incredible.
The way how I've always sort of gone and thought about it, I mean, because I know that like Brian sits on stage behind the piano, and I'm pretty sure he's not playing the entire time. He's just sitting there.
He picks and chooses, yeah.
A friend of mine was saying, well, you know, he's just really sitting there. And I'm saying, you know what? Think about any of the great classical composers. They can't be here in the 21st century to hear an orchestra play their work. We're getting a great composer here who every night gets to hear his work played by his personal orchestra. And that's privilege which us as an audience gets, is to watch the composer being given due respect.
Maurice, you nailed it on the head. Brian said that. For him, it's just sitting. If he could just sit on stage and listen to his band, he would. That would be his dream, is to have nobody in the hall and him to just sit on the stage and listen to that band perform his music and then go back to the hotel and order room service. That would be his greatest dream, because he does. He loves how they play that music, and he loves that band. And he's at every sound check. You know, there's a lot of artists out there, big name artists that we all know that don't show up at their sound checks. And sure. Brian's at every sound check, and he loves, because he loves to listen to that band. And I love that about Brian. I love that he likes his own music. You know what I mean? Like, he asks to hear his music, and you know, in the car, and he likes to hear it at sound check. And the cool thing would be to say, oh no, I played that album once, I recorded it and I never heard it again. You know, like, that's the cool thing to do. Like, oh no, I can, you know, that album's shit. You know, I can do, you know, I've done better since. That's always, yeah, I hear that a lot with directors who make films. They'll say, oh yeah, I've never watched that movie again. All I see are the flaws. Brian's not like that. Brian loves his music. You know, it makes him happy and he's proud of it. And I like that. I like that Brian likes his music and he likes to hear it. He likes his band, and he does. I mean, if you've seen, he's up there, son. He's just lost sometimes just listening to the music. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just digging it, listening to the music. Like I said, I think if Brian had his way, he would just sit in the middle of an empty stadium and listen to his band.
You've been very, very generous with your time, Brent. So I guess before we let you go, just final question is, what do you have next? Do you have a Harmony trilogy for us?
Yeah, I've got a long list of projects that Jason and I are trying to do together that haven't quite come to fruition yet, but we're pushing on them. So hopefully I'll have something to announce. But I like the idea of capturing these artists that maybe have not been terribly exposed, you know, pass on to a new generation that are incredible artists. I'd love to do the Otis Redding story. That's one that, you know, is out there, that is an artist that, you know, his life wasn't long enough, and, you know, what he did, and, you know, the music he left behind. And it breaks my heart that story hasn't been told yet. So if I had one wish, it'd be that one. And, you know, knock on wood, we're going to keep working it, you know, see if we can make it happen. But yeah, artists like that. I'd love to do some soul. I'd love to do Sam and Dave. I'd like to maybe explore a little bit of soul. You know, one of the things, you know, not getting too much into the weeds, is that, you know, the music docs are more popular, and, you know, you see everybody's rights being bought up, Springsteen, David Bowie, and Bob Dylan, everybody's selling their rights. And so you've got fewer companies who are managing and owning these rights, and they're big companies with big overheads, and, you know, that makes it tougher. You know, it's not cheap to clear these songs, and so that gets a little bit harder, but anything worth having is worth fighting for. Particularly if you don't want them to be the PR piece, right? Like, if you don't want them to, well, you know, we've seen them all, right? They're on Netflix every other month, some PR piece, you know, where they give you all access. And
the sort of stuff that used to come out of a bonus DVD that came with a reissue of a CD. Brent, this has been an absolute marvelous conversation. We've really had a wonderful time. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your film and Brian and harmonies, and we never got to discuss a deli, but never mind. Thank you so much, Brent.
Yeah, thank you guys. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you. Like I said, it's, you know, it's like geeking out with music fans, you know. How, you know, what more can you ask? If we just could have been drinking a few beers, that's the only thing we were missing.
Well, we do it every month, Brent, so you're welcome back anytime. Even if you just want to come on and talk about a film you like.
Absolutely. I'd love to. No, I'm a fan of the genre. That's why I love your guys' podcast.
Thank you so much.
Very kind of you.
Yeah, I think it's awesome that you guys shine a light on this genre and bring some respect and some credibility to an art that is really difficult, but yet I think brings a lot of joy to people. I really appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very kind. Thanks, Brent.
We're getting official acceptance from the upper echelon of filmmaking, Bernie. We must be doing something right.
It's taken us, what, 7-8 years? So we're getting there.
we're approaching our 100th episode, Brent, in about 3 months. 100 episodes, which only took us 8.5 years to get to. So
here's what we should do for the 100th episode. You should come to L.A. We'll go to the deli. We'll get Brian. We'll all go to the deli. And do it
can
there.
We hang out with Vanna White as well, please.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, Ben and Brian.
Amazing.
Isn't that a funny scene, by the way?
And that's great. That's just, again, one of those moments that you're just like, oh my God, where did that come from? So lucky to get that. That was great.
In love with Vanna White. In love with it.
And your one moment in the film, Brent.
Yes.
Don't worry, Brent's going to pay for it. Oh, Brent's going to pay for it. Oh, yeah. Have something more to drink.
Exactly. Yeah, he's so excited. Brian Wilson in a nutshell. Excited that somebody else is picking up lunch and then meeting Vanna White. Yep.
Way.
Yeah. Forget about Charmed Bono. Existence. I just met Vanna White.
Did Vanna White give him a Diet Coke, though? That's the question.
Yeah. All right. No, thank you so much, Brent. Bernie and I will be back in a moment to talk with you about what we have planned for episode 98 of See Here. Once again, our huge thanks to Brent Wilson for joining us for this month's episode of See Here. The film is available on all the usual platforms. I'm not sure. Forgot to ask him whether it's still got any cinema screenings around the States, but certainly you can get it on iTunes or any of the usual video on demand type platforms. I hope it gets a DVD release, because Bernie and I are old fashioned that way.
Yeah, a nice Blu-ray with some extra features would be great. Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, huge thanks to Brent, and we hope that any of you out there who are Beach Boys fans, go check out this documentary, and hope you enjoyed our conversation with Brent. Absolutely lovely fella. So next month on See Here, we are having another director who we've had on the show before. He came briefly on last month's show to talk about his documentary, which he's been working on for 10 years. I hope it shows up, about Erga Music War. But he previously came onto the show to talk about his film Ice Pick to the Moon, a documentary about the conceptual artist and musician Fred Lane. So we're welcoming back to the show Skiz Sizek, who's gone and made a documentary which I am so looking forward to watching, called Sound Mechanic. It's about a fellow called Neil Feather who makes instruments out of found objects. I've seen the trailer a ton of times. Looking forward to actually watching the film. This looks absolutely amazing, and I love a different approach, a different sort of subject for music documentary. So that should be a whole lot of fun. Looking forward to having Skiz back. Friend of the show, really, at this stage.
It's almost the fourth, I was going to say fourth Beatle, but maybe not.
No, they already had four. A fourth Seherian.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Okay, let's go with that.
So if you want to get in contact with us, you can send us an email, your good old-fashioned email, seeherepodcast@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/seeherepodcast.
Instagram, we are at seeherepodcast, all one word. Follow us for the occasional pictures and witty comments that I post.
We look forward to seeing what funny photo you have of Brian on the maybe ordering something from the deli, perhaps.
Yeah, or maybe just a picture of Anna White. I don't know, we'll see.
That is where people think, hey, how's this related to the film? What? All right, so until next month, we look forward to your company. Please be nice to each other. Watch some great movies and maybe watch some shit movies. It's all good. And we look forward to your company again next month. All the best. Cheers.
Cheers.
Of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.